Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with professor and founding director of the World Policy Analysis Center at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Dr. Jody Hyman, about how parental leave policies impact family health. I think this is an issue that's really important to all your health listeners, and one that we can learn from, know what the research is saying, and how we can improve. First, though, we're going to look at some research that matters, and the first one is about what's called celebrity fat shaming. We know that obesity is such a significant concern, and even among people who aren't obese, their beliefs, their thought processes about their own weight is particularly sometimes difficult. We see eating disorders. We see binge eating, all kinds of issues. We see the pressures on young adult women, on young women, of women of all ages, of men of all ages here. And we know that this celebrity fat shaming is something that's created a lot of, we might say, buzz around the country. And the question that these researchers wanted to know is, does this actually impact women who are watching and aware of this fat shaming? And these are researchers from McGill University in Canada. And they were looking at 20 instances of celebrity fat shaming, looking on what's called implicit attitudes that women have about their weight before and after this type of event. This was from 2004 to 2015. And implicit weight bias was on the rise during this time. And these are people's kind of what we call split-second reactions to something that they think is inherently good or bad. This was published in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, and it's a longitudinal research study called Project Implicit of participants who took an online weight implicit association test during an 11-year time period. And what they found is that these fat-shaming events, such as Kourtney Kardashian being fat shamed by her husband for not losing her post-pregnancy weight quickly enough in 2014, that these events led to a spike in women's implicit anti-fat attitudes, much more so after these notorious events with greater spikes. It doesn't mean that this proves a cause and effect here, but it does show that the culture's emphasis on the thin ideal may actually, and this fat shaming may actually contribute to worse problems. We do know that weight bias continues to be socially acceptable. It is discrimination, and it needs to change. I think more research that these researchers are planning to do to see if they can change these implicit biases would be really good. The next research that matters is about a different sort of problem in society that we don't hear a whole lot about, but it's associated actually with the increasing use of recreational marijuana. We do know that this recreational use has increased fairly dramatically, 43% in the United States between 2007 and 2015, with one out of eight Americans, adults, using cannabis during this time period, and the greatest increase among those who were between 26 and older. This corresponds with the increased legalization, the increased use of medical marijuana, and laws liberalizing. What's the question in this study, though, is what happens when people who are using marijuana go in for surgery? This was published in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association, and they looked at medical records of 250 patients who had endoscopic procedures after 2012. This might be for a colonoscopy. It could be for a gastrointestinal scoping. And they looked in Colorado after they, of course, had legalized recreational cannabis. And they found that those patients of the 250 who smoked or ingested cannabis daily or weekly required 14% more fentanyl, 20% more midazolam and 220% more propofol. Now, our listeners may not know exactly what those drugs are, but let's just say they're potent drugs associated with putting people to sleep during procedures. And they required that much more for sedation during routine procedures. Here's the catch. Those drugs with higher doses actually have risk and even higher risk. So I think what this is going to lead is that if you're a recreational frequent user of marijuana, you really do need to let your providers know. You need to let those who are doing the endoscopies or those who are doing the procedures on you know. And you have to be aware that this may require higher dosing to get the same level of anesthesia that is needed. I think there's unintended consequences in almost everything in life. This may be an unintended consequence of these more liberal marijuana laws that we need to have more research on. Speaking of more research, the next one is one of the more sobering pieces of research that I've seen in a long time. And this was in the American Journal of Public Health. And it's research about the rising rates of despair among Generation Xers once they enter middle age. This was done by researchers at the University of North Carolina and Vanderbilt. And what they were noticing is that in 2016, life expectancy began to decline for the first time in 25 years, and that it may be associated with increase in deaths due to overdoses from opioids, due to increased alcohol use and cirrhosis, and violent suicide among middle-aged patients, and frequently whites who live in rural areas. And so they really wanted to understand this better. And so they were looking at through a study called the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health, called AdHealth, fancy name, and that looks at the physical and mental health of thousands of Americans, adults born between 1974 and 1983, and tracked them from late teens through their late 30s and 40s. And they found that over time, that despair has increased in this. And it seems to occur across the 30s when patients have left the 20s. And it's regardless of their race, their ethnicity, their education, or where they live. This is real concern because it suggests there is really what we call a cohort effect. As people are aging, things are really starting to happen that make them less healthy, that make them more despondent. And I think this research demands a much greater dive and understanding of what the problem is and the solutions. And we're actually going to see if we can't book some of the researchers who have led this important research on your health and talk about this in more detail. The last research that matters is something that I saw on TV, maybe listeners saw on TV, and I thought I was looking at science fiction. It's not science fiction. It was scientists printing a 3D heart. Yes, they're doing 3D printing of a heart using the patient's biological materials. This engineered heart matches the immune functions, the cellular functions, the biochemical functions, the anatomical properties of where it came from, of the patient in this case. But this was actually done in a laboratory from Tel Aviv University. Fascinating. A vascularized engineered heart published in Advanced Science. I think this could be something that's Nobel Prize winning in the future. Maybe we can get one of the researchers on to talk about this whole process here. Because when I saw that little heart on the screen, I said, like, turn up the TV. I want to see what's going on here. And it's the first time where they've been able to use this three-dimensional. And the processes they use, this was the size of rabbit heart. It was very small, but it's the same technology that they would use for larger human hearts, where they can take tissue from a patient, they can separate different components of that tissue, then they can program that tissue to become different types of cells, to become the sorts of things that you can build a matrix of a heart on, to build a three-dimensional model for different types of cells, and then put this into a special gel where it can essentially be printed. I mean, come on, science fiction, this is great. I just think it's really important. It may help eliminate implant rejection. It may help to really cure or models for how to really help thousands, millions of people across the world who may be suffering from heart disease. I'm excited by it and look forward to really seeing the next stages of that research. That will conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking to Professor and Founding Director of the World Policy Analysis Center at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Dr. Jody Hyman, about how parental leave policies impact family health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking professor and founding director of the World Policy Analysis Center at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Dr. Jody Hyman, about how parental leave policies impact family health. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Hyman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You have some impressive credentials from some of the leading healthcare facilities in the world, like, you know, Harvard and UCLA and MD and public health. But I think we would like to know, how did you get started? Because I'm sure you didn't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a physician and a public health specialist in family leave.
So what really got me deeply into this was sitting in a community where there was low-cost housing. I was sitting with a bunch of moms, and I was already interested in caring for kids and pediatrics, and I was asking them about what their biggest challenges were. And I thought they might have said, I kind of expected them, because they were a group that had difficulty finding jobs, it might be that, or not enough money, and all those things, of course, affect a lot of people. But what they said was the biggest barrier was when their kids were sick and they couldn't care for them, and when they had a new child and they lost jobs trying to care for that child. And that was a wake-up call for me.
So you realize that there was something important that your experience sharing it with others needed further work.
Yeah, it was hearing it from moms themselves before we actually then started to look at the national data to see if their experiences were common. And once we looked at the national data, we found that among the most common reasons for losing jobs were giving birth to a new child or having a child get sick. And so that experience they were having of not being able to do both, of obstacles getting in the way, not because they didn't have the will or desire to do both, was pretty common across the country.
So if we were to back up for a second and say, let's look back 20, 30, 40 years ago, was this issue just as important then, but we didn't understand it? Or has the workplace changed, and so therefore it's now more important than ever before?
Yeah, so you're about to show my age, because I started working on this probably almost 30 years ago. So it's been a problem for a long time, and the world has changed. What's really changed is when I started working on it, you might have been able to find 10 or 15 countries in the world that didn't have paid maternity leave, for example. Now, they're practically none. Now, the few other countries that were kind of lagging behind, Australia, New Zealand, they got their house in order, and it's the U.S., Papua New Guinea, and a few small South Pacific Island countries. So what's changed is that we haven't changed and the rest of the world has, but I think it's been a challenge American families are facing for too long.
So let's dive right into parental leave. What is the current situation in the United States, and does it vary by locality or states? What do we know about it for women and for men and partners?
Yeah, so, you know, the one Good News piece, which, you know, which happened over 25 years ago, was the Family Medical Leave Act. That makes sure that people can take unpaid leave in the United States when a child's sick or when they have a new baby. And at the time it was passed, people thought very soon after it would turn to paid leave. That's the step we missed. Now, it's important for listeners to know that while the Family Medical Leave Act was important for about half of Americans, half of Americans don't even get the unpaid benefit. And that's because it only covers companies that are a certain size, have enough employees, and, you know, it has a lot of limitations. You have to have worked enough hours. So who gets paid leave? There are some states that do that now. California passed a law in 2002 after California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, New York, most recently Washington, and Massachusetts. So seeing that the country hadn't done it, more and more states are starting to, but we still have a long way to go.
So if we think about the rationale for why it needs to be done and why it's not done, can you articulate what are the reasons given? Because it seems fairly obvious that this is a good thing for parents and children, families, mothers, fathers, all of it.
Yeah, so there are lots of reasons to do it. I'll do those first, then I'll do the reasons people say it's not possible. So the reasons to do it are babies do much better. One of the really closest things we have to a magic bullet in terms of newborn and infant and toddler health is breastfeeding. It lowers rates of pneumonia and bronchitis and diarrhea. It lowers obesity. It lowers diabetes. It decreases the chance of sudden infant death. Mothers who breastfeed have less breast cancer. They have less diabetes. So this is an amazing thing that nature created. And it's much easier to follow the recommendations of every health organization, which is only give breast milk for 6 months if there's paid maternity leave. Beyond that, moms bonding with their kids, dads bonding with their kids. Dads taking leave lowers mom's depression rates and postpartum depression that we've seen more in the news lately about what a serious problem it is. So there are lots of health benefits. And then there are the economic benefits. Families at this critical time in their life don't lose 3 months, 6 months of earnings that they're not likely to be able to afford. So what's the argument against? The main argument in the United States that's been made against it is that we can't afford it as a country. Now, I think that's just really hard to believe when you look at the fact that every other major economy can afford it. And the state that's had it the longest, California, has one of the strongest economies in the country. So I don't think the evidence is good that we can't afford it, but that is the argument that's made.
So it's an economic argument that unpaid leave is one thing, paid leave could be something else, and even unpaid leave has an economic consequence.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's really arguing against the unpaid leave now. At the time it passed, they did argue against it. And then there were follow-up studies where people interviewed the companies, and they said it really hasn't cost us anything significant to provide. Of course, there are some costs to unpaid leave or to paid leave of replacing the employee during that period. But there are also costs to not providing it. The company has to recruit someone new. They have to train someone new. And in most countries, the cost of paid leave is not borne by the company. It's paid through social insurance.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, I want to actually find out from you, who's doing it the best in the world? What can we learn from them? What are the models? What's the chances of regulatory or legislative reform happening? What's the research that needs to happen? And how do we get from here to there? A small task, Dr. Hyman.
Great. Fantastic.
So we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Professor and Founding Director of the World Policy Analysis Center at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Dr. Jody Hyman, about how parental leave policies impact family health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Professor and Founding Director of the World Policy Analysis Center, Dr. Jody Hyman at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, about how parental leave policies impact family health. And Dr. Hyman, right before we broke, I think you made a compelling argument for why these parental leave policies are good public policy, economic, healthcare sense. And I wonder, what do we know internationally? Because sometimes we may learn things internationally that are really helpful for us here in the United States.
Well, so what we know internationally is, first, out of 193 countries in the world, 187 have paid maternity leave. More than half have paid paternity leave. So this is incredibly common. Of the high-income countries, really everybody but the United States has paid maternity leave, and overwhelmingly, nearly all have paid paternity leave. So we're really quite an outlier. These tend to be long. So if you look at the long by U.S. standards, if you look at the high-income countries, 25 out of 34 of the OECD countries have at least 6 months of paid leave for moms. 24 out of 34 have at least 3 months for dads. So this is a lot of leave, and they economically succeed at the same time. So we did a study, we took a look. How about those with low unemployment rates? Did they have paid leave? Yes. The ones who had high GDP and high growth, did they have paid leave? Yes. So all the indicators are good that it's affordable.
So given that, I must ask the question, what is stopping it federally and for more states? And, you know, in my own field of public health research, which is on tobacco policy, the analogy might be, we know that raising the price lowers consumption dramatically. It's a good thing. Many other countries have done it, but we have sometimes difficult doing it here. California led the way. New York's led the way. And the states seem to be that battleground of where great advances are. Is this just the natural history that we're going to get there, but it's just taking too long?
Well, it could be that it will happen state by state, and I would certainly encourage your listeners in different states to make it happen in their own state, to talk to their legislators, to talk to their representatives, because we can make a difference state by state. I do hope that it happens soon at a national level. I've spent time with across the political spectrum on Capitol Hill, and there is widespread understanding that this matters to families, it matters to mom and dads, and it matters to kids. There are different approaches to it, and around the world you'd see different approaches. Some that would look a lot like Social Security, but instead of getting a benefit when you're elderly, you get a benefit when you have a new child. Some that would look much more like a tax credit, where you get a check when you have a new baby that allows you that time off. There can be a range of viewpoints on the best way to do it, but we should be able to sit down as a country and decide that it's essential to do and pass some way that families can have time with their children and for healthy children on a newborn and sick children at critical times.
Well, and I'm hoping you can share with us some model legislation, some model tips for how listeners can become engaged. This sounds like advocacy is needed and people can advocate, and that would be something that is useful. In your work with the World Policy Analysis Center, tell us what's that center doing and how can listeners find out more about that?
So we nickname it World. That's the short name. And listeners can find out more about it on our website, which is just worldpolicycenter.org. And they can see maps of what every country around the world is doing on paid maternity, paid paternity leave. But they can also see maps on what is every country doing around education, around secondary school, around affordable university, and a range of areas. And the goal of the center is really just to make this information available to citizens so they can look and say, this looks feasible. Other countries that I respect, their citizens are getting this benefit. Maybe we could here too. Or look at something else and say, great, I'm proud that we're leading the way in this area, but I'm concerned that we're lagging behind in this other area that matters to our health.
And when we think about any issue today in healthcare, as someone who's passionate about everything that public health has to offer, we also want to make sure that we're addressing disparities, because we might improve something but increase disparities. Is there work that we know that as the states are moving into this, that we're actually both helping those who really can benefit but also decreasing disparities so that we're not making it worse with one policy?
Every time we make parental leave paid, we're reducing disparities. So right now, the biggest disparity, unpaid family medical leave, when Americans were asked who took advantage of it and who didn't, overwhelmingly the people who did not make use of the leave, who were able to spend no time with their newborn or no time with a sick child or a dying parent, it was because they couldn't afford it. So when it's unpaid, there are huge disparities. When we make it paid, we lower the disparities. And to your point of what we each do, I just want to mention one other thing. If any listener, if you do visit worldpolicycenter.org and see the maps, they all have share icons. So I think one thing we can all do, not only speaking to our representatives, but is share with other people the information about areas where the United States really could do more for the health of the whole population.
And maybe we'll not only put the link to the website, maybe we'll encourage listeners to share. I think that's a lovely, empowering idea. You know, you have fought and done so many remarkable things, both in your current position as the longtime dean of the School of Public Health at UCLA, boards and books. What wakes you up and motivates you each and every day to do work that's really empowering for mothers and families?
What really wakes me up, both in the United States but also in other countries, because we work around the world, are the people I've met who are struggling so much and aren't having a choice. The mom and dad whose baby was sick and at risk of dying because they had to stop breastfeeding. Mom had to stop breastfeeding at 6 weeks to go back to work, and the child immediately, as we could predict and could have prevented, got sick. Or the dad who lost his job trying to care for a child in the hospital. These are solvable problems, and they're completely within our reach.
Well, I think on behalf of Your Health listeners, I need to thank you, Dr. Jody Hyman, for your commitment, your passion, your vision, and leadership. Obviously, it requires all four, and our listeners can take stock in knowing that you're doing that, and we all have roles to play.
Thank you so much, Adam, for all you do, and to all the listeners for caring to engage in this.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. We want to thank Dr. Jody Hyman, founding director of the World Policy Analysis Center, for being our guest today. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Well, welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener would like to share a question or concern, they can send it to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
Sometimes I'm feeling like I'm losing my mind. I'm only 35, but in the last 3 years, I seem to be becoming more and more forgetful. People around me have jokingly said that I must have early Alzheimer's, but I don't really find that funny because I have a family history of Alzheimer's on my dad's side. My wife thinks it's just stress, and I'm just curious, what's the best way to determine if this is just stress or a more significant memory problem?
Well, first off, it's a serious and important question, and I think my first instinct when people said something kind of rude and inconsiderate, I'd like to say, that's kind of rude and inconsiderate, or, you know what, that's not as funny to me because of this. And I don't think people are saying it like they're trying to be mean, but clearly there's a concern here.
Yeah.
And you're concerned, your wife's concerned, and I think anytime I hear that two people are concerned, that means you should be in to see your provider, you know, whether it's a primary care provider or a specialist. And share that concern. Mm-hmm. And it's not unusual for me to sometimes hear something similar. And a lot of times I'm thinking, is this what we call dementia?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be young at this age, very unlikely statistically, or is it not really stress, because stress isn't necessarily a diagnosis as much as depression or anxiety or adjustment disorder or something in the realm of psychological, which statistically at that age is comparing those two. One is like 99.999% and the other is 0.001, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible. You know, I'd want to know, did you have concussions?
Right.
You know, if you had other sort of, you know, kind of head trauma, what else is going on? Are there other symptoms like Parkinson's that could, you know, tremors or things that could suggest something early going on? Have you ever had a blackout like a stroke? Are you on medications that can mimic both? So sometimes some medicines, antihistamines can be, you know, oral sleep medicines or things like that. So some questions, but more frequently, we'd like to do some testing. You can do testing for dementia, some very simple tests. One's called a MOCA, M-O-C-A. It's out of Montreal, an assessment test. There's what's called a MNS, the mini mental status examination. These are very short, 5 to 10 minute questionnaires that your physician can do in their office. You can get a score up to 30, 25, whatever the scoring is, and you'll probably score perfectly fine. It's some short-term memory questions, some short-term kind of abstraction, some writing, some calculations. You know, can you count backwards from 100 by 7?
93.
Yeah, let me take away 7 more, and we go to that 3 times. I say, you know, why don't you, can you remember 5 things? Rock, church, red, dog, person, and I might have you repeat those 5 things back to me a couple times so you've remembered them. And that's, you know, it's a minute later. Could you remember those 5 things?
Oh,
3 minutes later, could you remember those 5 things? Things like that. So in this case, those things would probably be normal. And then we'd also like to say, why don't you take some other tests? And one might be what's called a depression screen. Another could be an anxiety screen and see how you score on those. My guess is that you're going to score much higher on those screens and maybe be mild, moderate, or severely depressed or anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, that could really mimic dementia. It could certainly cause memory problems because they're global functioning.
Right.
So that wouldn't be too surprising probably. So I wouldn't say your wife is right. I would say that you're both right.
Right.
You're concerned, she's concerned. It'd be time to get in, and we could probably figure out what could help in this situation.
That sounds like a great plan.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it helps this listener and other listeners. What's our very next house call?
Recently, I saw my doctor for my annual physical. Overall, I felt pretty good. I had lost some weight and my blood pressure was down. But on the other hand, I have been having some headaches and some pain in the back of my head that does seem to be getting worse. My doctor said this is almost certainly arthritis of the neck after doing the physical exam. How can she be so certain just based on my history and the physical exam?
Well, for one reason, they're a professional who may well have seen hundreds, if not thousands, right, or tens of thousands of patients, and maybe have seen patterns. A lot of medicine is pattern recognition. You know, someone comes in with chest pain and they're putting their hand over their heart and it hurts when they're walking. It doesn't take too long to say, that's probably angina, right? Someone loses vision in one side of their eye, you think, that's serious, right? So you recognize some patterns. In this particular case, pain in the back of the neck with no other symptoms. And maybe when this doctor felt the back of the neck, they felt tight muscles, tender areas. That is frequently arthritis. It could be a tension, but, you know, why would tension just manifest at that point in time? So it could be, and you have to distinguish those things. What the doctor might say is they may think that it's arthritis, and they may say, you know, I think at this point in time we would do a neck x-ray just to confirm that diagnosis. Now, if you didn't see arthritis on the neck x-ray, you would say probably not arthritis. We should be looking for other things. You might check some blood work to make sure it's not some other things, other types of arthritis. But if the blood work was negative, you saw arthritis on the x-ray, the history, the physical, the objective laboratory x-ray findings all would say, ah, this is arthritis. And that is common, and common things happen commonly. So I think the doctor probably is that, but we shouldn't be cavalier. We should say this could be arthritis. That can be a chronic condition. I know this could be difficult. It's over the long term, and it's a conversation starter, not the end of a conversation.
Right.
I think good doctors can sometimes figure these things out pretty quickly. But you know what? Uncommon things do also happen, even though they're uncommon. So I think keeping in the back of your mind that it could be something else.
Keep watching just in case, but this is likely what it is.
Yeah, and probably don't need like an MRI in this particular case. What's our very last house call?
I've had high blood pressure and diabetes for many years, and to help control my diabetes, my doctors have put me on a medicine called metformin. Over time, though, they've increased the dose, and while it worked initially to control my blood sugar, it also seems to have led to increasing problems with loose stools and occasional soiling. Is it reasonable to ask for a different medicine that doesn't do that, or should I just be grateful that my blood sugars are well controlled?
Well, I said always be grateful that your blood sugars are controlled, but I would ever say that then don't be worried about
stooling,
right?
Yeah.
It's not either or, it's and. Yeah. So I think we've got a problem here. You know, we do need to intervene here because this is a major problem. It interferes with life and quality, and it's embarrassing. There's lots of kind of issues. And guess what? We could use other medicines if we need to. We can reduce the dose. You know, there are so many different sorts of diabetes medicines on the markets now, and most of these have really kind of fancy names and even fancier costs associated with them. But, you know, you can ask your doctors about medicines called sulfonylureas or DPP-4 inhibitors or SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1 receptor.
Oh, it's like alphabet soup.
Alphabet soup. Yeah, you can ask the doctor about the alphabet, the ABCs of other drugs. Again, some old standby drugs, medicines called glipizide, inexpensive, a good medicine. May not be the best medicine for you. There may be other medicines, but you got to figure out what the cost of the medicines is, the convenience of the medicines, the effectiveness of the medicines, and oh yes, the side effects of the medicines. Mm-hmm. Really worth asking about. Well, that'll conclude our house call today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you, and you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu for any question or concern you have. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Jody Hammond. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.